Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. What a difficult week. What a gut-wrenching week. Capped off, of course, by the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, hyper-partisan frat boy. We have a big show this week. We're going to talk to Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate. Then we'll be joined by Ari Berman, a writer for Mother Jones, who covers election integrity, voter suppression, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, we'll be joined by Brian Schaffner, a political scientist at Tufts University. We've got a lot to cover, so we're just going to jump right into it this week. I'm joined now by the great Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia is a senior editor at Slate, and she also hosts the podcast Amicus, which you should check out wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to the show, Dahlia.
Thank you for having me.
I should tell listeners that we are taping this moments after Susan Collins gave a belabored 50-minute rambling speech justifying her support for Brett Kavanaugh. You know, I mean, just...
We could probably just stop, right? That sigh.
It's just exhausting. All right, so let me ask you
this. I described it as the worst rose ceremony in reality television history. So let's just go with that.
Yeah, no, that fits. So, all right, we had this charade. We have all seen that there was not a careful investigation beyond the allegations of sexual assault, beyond questions about his honesty or lack thereof during the confirmation hearings. Isn't it clear to everyone that we shouldn't have a partisan hack on the Supreme Court? How did we get here? Do you think that he would have been confirmed, say, 25 years ago in an era of less partisan animosity, of cooler heads?
I do. I think that he, you know, started and ended his non-judicial career as a, you know, political operative. We know, you know, the role he played in the Starr investigation. We know the role he played, you know, in Bush v. Gore, in the you know, what they call the Brooks Brothers Revolution.
Yes.
We know, you know, his story is not a story of, you know, a kind of a guy who graduates law school and thinks fanciful thoughts about arcane notions and then becomes a judge. This is somebody who, you know, even in his tenure in the Bush White House, was aggressively placing, you know, right-wing judges on the bench. And I think, you know, the sort of many Miranda stolen document scandal, all of the stuff in his hearings up to the moment this became a question about Dr. Blasey Ford, the weakest moments in his hearings were about exactly what you just described. This was an operative, and that's fine. I don't think anybody has a problem with that, but he was weirdly unwilling to talk about those times. Those were the moments, I think, during the hearings that material untruths were told about things that he had done prepping judges, you know, that Bush was pushing through, working behind the scenes to get judges on the bench, you know, claims he made at those times about those judges. Those were the things that he couldn't cop to during the hearing. So even before we got to, you know, the sexual abuse allegations. And so I think, you know, would he have gotten confirmed? Sure. Operatives get confirmed all the time. But I think that he got a little bit tripped up in the whole balls and strikes, I'm just, you know, a neutral umpire, because his history doesn't in any way map onto that. And I think that's the problem we have, is that we tell this lie now. I think we can probably date it to John Roberts when he started saying, you know, judges are just completely, you know, brains in vats, their political background doesn't matter, their predilections don't matter. And I think mapping Brett Kavanaugh's history as a lawyer onto that story was never going to be a good fit.
It obviously caused him discomfort because he wrote that op-ed in the Wall Street Journal where he said that he was, you know, he was a fair and impartial justice. He would be a fair and impartial justice. And it's striking because in that very op-ed, I think he was mendacious because he tried to make it seem as if It was a spontaneous emotional outburst. I'm referring now to his going after Democratic senators on the Justice Committee, especially women. And yet the most partisan parts of his remarks were in his prepared testimony. He had spent days prepping at the White House. He had, you know, carefully written and rewritten that testimony, and that was the plan, right?
Well, I think that what you saw in that Wall Street Journal op-ed was an anxiety that was separate from the Me Too, Blasey Ford, Debbie Ramirez conversation that emerged yes. last week. What you saw in that op-ed was the legal establishment, including John Paul Stevens, right, Republican appointee to the Supreme Court, the American Bar Association, 2,400 and counting law professors across the spectrum. Their objections that arose after the hearing you're describing, that wasn't about Dr. Ford. That was about temperament. That was about, can you sit on the Supreme Court and say, under the judicial canons, I have not prejudged, you know, parties before me or issues before me, having ranted about a dark money Clinton avenging conspiracy by Democrats. And I think that what you saw was, I'm not going to talk about the merits of these allegations against me. I'm going to change the subject and talk about my temperament. And so I think really the way that we saw this play out, I think, over the weekend and into this week, Donald Trump gets up in Mississippi and just flat out mocks Dr. Blasey Ford. There's nothing Brett Kavanaugh can do to win that argument anymore. He is forever tethered to that. So what he does is he has to answer this question of temperament. And what you saw in the Wall Street Journal, I think, was an effort to rehabilitate the idea that, okay, I had a little momentary, not very judicial, you know, rage disordered thing.
Yeah,
and
right.
Now I'm going to be okay. And that's, I think, what he was worried about was not even, I think, the sexual assault stuff. I think it was the temperament stuff that was leaching into the legal academy and, you know, the judicial branch. And it was getting a lot of people who otherwise supported him very, very anxious about the effect on the Supreme Court.
Now, John Roberts supposedly, I don't know how true these things are or not. The conventional wisdom is that he is a fierce institutionalist who is extremely concerned about the legitimacy of the court, of its perceived legitimacy. He is now the new swing vote. How do you see him as a court watcher behaving over the next 30 years?
Well, I think that, you know, there's two things. I think there is sort of the Brett Kavanaugh specific issues. And then I think just generally there's John Roberts. I think if we had had this conversation 2 weeks ago, I would have said, look, John Roberts is and has always been an institutionalist. He very much is in the mold of his hero, former Chief Justice Rehnquist. He thinks about the court first. That explains his defections in the Affordable Care Act when
right.
he preserves the integrity of the court because it's more important than these short-term wins. And I think that John Roberts is very much going to show up in the coming years. But does that mean he's not a movement conservative, a lifelong, you know, Federalist Society movement conservative? No. I think we have to be really clear that John Roberts is not going to let the court toggle wildly to the right and start overturning Roe on the first day of, you know, that they can. I think John Roberts is very, very savvy, and we've seen him do this, including this last term, by the way, in the unions case where the court, you know, just overruled a longstanding precedent with the stroke of a pen. We'll see it happen in small incremental ways. I think one of the fallacies of the Susan Collins take on this is it's a perfectly binary question. You either overturn Roe or you don't. And we all know that you can do away with Roe without ever writing the words Roe v. Wade is overturned. So I think John Roberts is going to be very anxious based on what happened in the last few weeks about the integrity and the legitimacy of the court. That will be something that we will see play out, I think, probably this term and next as he tries to reconstruct this facade of we're all just calling balls and strikes. But I don't think that that means that the court isn't in dramatic, dramatic ways going to move very, very quickly and decisively to the right on virtually every issue, from voting rights to affirmative action to abortion rights to LGBTQ rights. I mean, I think all of those things are back on the table. Pretty much anything where Anthony Kennedy had been kind of sweeping back the sea in the last few decades, I think, is now up for grabs.
Right. The moderating influence is now down to John Roberts, who, as you say, is a movement conservative who does not have the same kind of heterodox views that the swing justice he's replacing did. Okay, so there is a certain conventional wisdom, and if you're looking for a silver lining, perhaps it is here. There is a certain conventional wisdom that says that the court has been polarized in an asymmetric fashion by conservatives. They've spent 30 or 40 years questioning the legitimacy of the court itself as an institution. They talk about, you know, liberal justices being robed tyrants and judicial activists, et cetera, et cetera. We all know the shtick. And on the left, according to this, again, popular view, there is a tendency to criticize specific rulings, the substance and process by which they got there, without calling into question the legitimacy of the court itself or the integrity of the conservative justices. First of all, do you agree with that analysis? Secondly, how might things change if that is no longer the case, and if people on the left also come to see, and I think that that's obviously happening, come to see this as a Republican court that is not fair, is not neutral, is not, you know, an institution separate from the political the branch of government separate from the political branches.
I mean, I think on your descriptive point, you are absolutely right. I think that all the data supports the idea that, you know, Republicans have been fantastically effective and deft at organizing around the Supreme Court as a voting issue for decades, and that Democrats sort of hit the snooze button and sometimes still think, you know, this is the Warren Court, and forget that massive, massive aggregate losses on, you know, voting rights in Shelby County and on, you know, reproductive rights before whole women's health change that. But, you know, in issue after issue, probably the high water mark is Citizens United, that, you know, Republican outcomes were being served at the court, and that the court had become a vehicle for promoting, you know, big business and other interests and union busting and other interests that were really aligned with the Republican Party. And so I think there has been a tendency, you're exactly right, for Democrats to get really focused on individual cases, to say, you know, I don't like how Citizens United was decided. I don't much care for Hobby Lobby. You know, I think that the court maybe made a mistake in striking down the Voting Rights Act in Shelby County, but also not organizing around elections and saying there's a way to fix this. And that is, you know, in 2016, there's a vacant seat. There's an 83 and an 80 and a 78-year-old justice. Maybe this should be a voting issue. And I don't think Democrats and progressives have been very good at organizing around that. And we saw in the 2016 election, all the exit polls bore that out by about a 2-to-1 margin. People who ranked the court as their number one voting issue broke for Donald Trump. So I think you're right descriptively. And then the question is, does this become the moment where Democrats say maybe the snooze button was wrong and maybe this has to be the single defining electoral issue going forward? You know, I don't know. It's hard to say. I think that the fact that in 2016, Democrats didn't think that a vacant seat on the court was worth going out and holding their nose and voting for Hillary Clinton. If it didn't motivate them, it's hard to know what changes. I think in one sense, what we've seen in the last few weeks is a real, I think, sort of slow-moving argument for this is about power, and that the norms of advise and consent, the norms of meaningful investigation, the norm of having the nominees' documents vetted properly at the, you know, archives, all of those norms exploded. And long before Dr. Blasey Ford came along, this looked like it was unusual and it was being rushed and it was partisan. Whether this becomes the fulcrum around which Democrats say, holy cow, we maybe lost the courts and we should vote on that, it's hard to know. I think it's a really intriguing political question about why this doesn't have salience and why it might have salience. And it's probably out of my wheelhouse to understand why it hasn't. But I think you're absolutely right that that's been, as an organizing principle, it's been very, very much pushed way down the food chain to sort of eighth or ninth priority for Democrats.
I mean, this is the only thing, hopeful thing that I have is that that's going to change. Before I let you go, your view on there are calls now for packing the courts if Democrats attain the power to do so. Your view on that?
You know, there's a lot of interesting arguments being floated now by Democrats, and I think we should really grapple with them. There are arguments about term limits, right? Putting in an 18-year term limit so that justices don't sit for 40 years. There's arguments about whether we should think about reinstating the filibuster if Democrats take control of the Senate. And
that makes me crazy, by the way.
I mean,
that one just makes me nuts. What are you talking about? You're going to get totally robbed and then be like, okay.
Yeah, it's a baby spoon to a knife fight, right? But I think that there are all sorts of versions of this, and one of them is, you know, court packing, just simply adding new seats. I mean, they all in some ways suffer from the similar problem of, you know, we know FDR tried this, and as a very popular president tried this, and the country really balked, and it balked because I think there's something sacrosanct about this institution, about the idea of nine justices, about not politicizing the court, not turning it into a football. So then I think the question really becomes, I think this is underlying your question, have we got to the point that that magical aspirational thinking around the court is gone? And I think we may have. It may in fact be, I think I wrote this morning, the court may just be broken and we may be back in an era where Americans lack all public confidence in the institution, and then whatever the party in power decides to do, whether it's court packing or term limits or whatever it is, good, because it's about power. The answer to all those questions is we could certainly be there. I worry, as somebody who's covered the courts for 20 years and who still believes in some of that magical thinking, believes that the institution requires a certain suspension of this level of cynicism. I worry about what it will do to the court. And so the sort of polemical political answer is, of course, Democrats need to do whatever they can to win this thing. But I also absolutely can tell you that the court is at its absolute weakest in terms of the work it needs to do when the American public is as cynical as we may have to become now.
I interviewed a historian a few years ago, and she was talking about how she was talking about the 1920s and 1930s after the Depression. She said that everything was up in the air. Everything was up for debate. There were people who were fascists. There were people who were communists. There, you know, things that had long been considered settled matters in American political life were all of a sudden up for debate. And I think that it's entirely possible that, you know, the series of events that included certainly the Great Recession, the Iraq War, and Donald Trump's election and subsequent destruction of norms left and right may be putting us into a similar place. And you see this certainly with things like, you know, fealty to international institutions and multilateralism and trade. Things that were very much settled on a bipartisan basis are suddenly up in the air. Dahlia, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me on a very depressing day.
I want to apologize for the sound of my text binging, and I want to thank you so much for having me on this incredibly, I think it will be really, really remembered as a kind of a ground-shifting day.
Yeah, it's a Pearl Harbor. It's a 9/11. Dahlia Lithwick, check her out at Slate. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back. Welcome back. I got to tell you, all of my colleagues at The Nation miss my next guest dearly. Ari Berman writes for Mother Jones. He's probably the country's premier reporter covering all issues related to voting rights and election integrity. He's also the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We talked to him about that book when it came out. Ari, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Hey, Josh, and I miss you guys, too, although I still think of you as colleagues in the most expansive sense of the word.
We all do, too. Folks, we're recording this at the end of the day on October 4th, and we don't know for sure what will happen by the time this airs. It's looking likely that Brett Kavanaugh will be confirmed as a justice of the Supreme Court after Republicans crafted a Potemkin investigation, if you will, to give them some political cover for voting for him. It's not over, but it's looking bleak. Ari, I spoke with Dahlia Lithwick about the Kavanaugh nomination. So I just want to talk to you about him in relation to your beat. He's been a circuit court judge for 12 years. He was obviously a political operative before that. You wrote a piece, which listeners can check out at motherjones.com, titled Kavanaugh's Record Doesn't Bode Well for Voting Rights. What do we know about his views on this issue, on federal actions to protect voters, etc.?
The most disturbing opinion that I saw was that when Kavanaugh was on the D.C. Circuit Court, he voted to uphold a voter ID law from South Carolina in 2012 that the Obama administration had blocked and said would disenfranchise tens of thousands of minority voters. And Kavanaugh put this law into effect, and his reasoning was very disturbing because basically he said that essentially states could enact any restrictions on voting that they wanted, even if there was no evidence of fraud to justify those restrictions. And he basically said, I'm reading from the opinion now, that we conclude that South Carolina's goals of preventing voter fraud and increasing electoral confidence are legitimate. Those interests cannot be deemed pretextual merely because of an absence of recorded incidents of in-person voter fraud in South Carolina. So basically what he's saying is, even if there's no fraud, you can make it harder for tens of thousands of people to be able to vote. And that is extremely worrisome, because basically he could uphold any restriction on voting now for any reason, except for the stated reason of why these laws are passed, which is to try to prevent a kind of fraud that is not occurring. So I'm really worried that in this opinion, he basically left the door open to essentially blanket voter suppression, even if there's no rationale for the restrictions.
And I mean, it is integral to a judge's job to establish the facts of a case before deciding on it. You said that this was in 2012, so that's a year before the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, right?
Yeah, it's a year before the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. He was asked at his confirmation hearing what he thought about that opinion. He basically didn't say anything about it. But he did say he was proud of that South Carolina opinion, which I found worrisome. And so I think his record is that, you know, I don't see any difference between him and all the other conservatives on the court in terms of upholding voter ID laws, weakening the Voting Rights Act. He's also written opinions that would make it easier for foreign interests to interfere in an election. So he essentially could make the kind of interference that the Russians did in 2016 legal through his opinions. And he's obviously been very hostile to any regulation on getting big money out of politics. He's been kind of an absolutist on the Citizens United front. And so I think he's basically someone that has an ideology of making it easier for large interests and corporations to try to buy an election and make it harder for minorities and low-income people to vote in an election. And I think that is the ideology that the four other justices on the court have. And I think he's going to bring that ideology. And I'm very worried that we're going to have a 5-member majority in the court that is pretty much down the line hostile to voting rights.
For decades to come. Let's shift gears a little bit, because we're less than 5 weeks out from the midterms. The most important election of our lifetimes was 2016. We blew it. This is the second most important, because Donald Trump currently enjoys impunity by congressional majority, and his president, as we have known it for the past 2 years, will come to an end if there's real oversight. Looking at the voting rights, election integrity landscape from a bird's eye view, what are you most worried about, Ari?
Well, I mean, there's what am I most worried about in 2018, and there's what I'm most worried about long term. What I'm worried about in 2018 is a few different things. The first thing that I'm worried about is that 23 states have passed new voting restrictions since the 2010 election, and about 8 states are going to have new restrictions in effect for the first time in 2018. So it's objectively become harder to vote in a bunch of really important states. The second thing I'm concerned about is that there have been all of these rulings striking down gerrymandered maps in the lower courts, but all of those rulings have essentially been upheld by the Supreme Court, meaning that the Supreme Court has upheld districts that have been ruled by lower courts to be unconstitutional. So that means that there's going to be a bunch of competitive House races and state legislative races that are taking place in essentially illegal districts. And I think the third related thing that I'm worried about is the fact that in 13 states, people are going to vote on voting machines with no paper backups, meaning that if there is some controversy over the results, we're not going to be able to verify them in places like Georgia, which are really important swing states in this election, and that the Trump administration has done basically nothing to try to secure a state election system. So I think if you look at the voting restrictions that are in effect, you look at the gerrymandering, look at the security of our election systems writ large, I think there's a lot of concerns about the integrity of our election system in 2018.
I mean, I would take it a step further when it comes to securing electoral systems, which is that they've been actively blocking efforts to do so. I'm, of course, worried about everything because the stakes are so high. You know, I've said repeatedly on this show that the federal government shouldn't be a significant source of stress. It should hum along in the background, collect taxes, send out Social Security checks, like do the business of governing without freaking us all out 7 times a day. Another big picture question. Are there things that you're hopeful about or efforts that you're seeing to push back on this situation that you think might be effective that people should maybe get involved in?
Yeah, there's actually a lot that I'm hopeful about. I'm probably more hopeful in this election with regards to voting rights than any election in about a decade. So the one of the things that I'm most hopeful about is that there are going to be a bunch of ballot initiatives to expand voting rights. So voters have the opportunity to take their initiatives in their own hands and do something about this problem. And the thing that I'm most excited about is there's an initiative in Florida that would restore voting rights to 1.4 million ex-felons. And I write about this in the new issue of Mother Jones. But Florida is one of only one of four states that prevents ex-felons from voting, meaning you've already served your time, you've paid your debt to society, but you still can't vote for life unless you're pardoned by the governor. And very few people have been pardoned by this current governor, Rick Scott, who is now running for the Senate. And there's a ballot initiative to change this. And it needs 60% of the vote to pass, which is a pretty high bar. But there's been this massive and growing bipartisan movement in the state, led by ex-offenders who themselves can't vote, to try to overturn this felon disenfranchisement law that prevents 10% of Floridians from voting, which is a staggering number of people that are prevented from voting, and including one in five African Americans in the country's most important swing state. So this is going to be on the ballot. Right now it's polling with about three-fourths support from voters, which shows me that there's actually a lot more support at the grassroots level for expanding voting rights than there is in the upper echelons of the Republican Party. But it's not just Florida. There's going to be initiatives in places like Michigan for Election Day and automatic registration. There's going to be initiatives for nonpartisan redistricting in four states. There's going to be initiatives for automatic registration in other states like Nevada. And so about eight different states, including some really important swing states, places like Michigan and Florida and Nevada, have an opportunity directly at the grassroots level to change some of these policies. So I think that's what I'm hopeful about. The second thing I'm hopeful about is that I think we're going to see change in the political dynamics here. I think we're going to see change in who governors are and who secretaries of state are and who state legislatures are. And I think that's going to be huge because the states are really where the battle has been with regards to voting rights. And there's so much attention on Trump, and there's secondarily so much attention on the Congress. But with my beat, the states matter the most. And we could see some very, very different people elected in the states, and they could pursue very different policies. I think that's the quickest way to change things.
Polls were out this week showing that both the voting rights package and nonpartisan districting were leading in Michigan. The poll came out, I think, on Tuesday. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Ari Berman from Mother Jones. You mentioned gerrymandering. If you can demonstrate that it was that districts were drawn according to race, that is generally a no-go according to the courts. They have long accepted that the parties could redistrict to gain a partisan advantage, basically a distinction without that much difference. Because if you draw lines to concentrate, say, African-American votes into a district, you're going to have the effect of disadvantaging Democrats. Now, with voter targeting becoming so sophisticated, it had looked like the Supreme Court might consider invalidating partisan gerrymandering, but that was before Justice Kennedy announced his retirement. Where do you think this battle is going?
Well, where I think this battle is going is away from the Supreme Court, meaning that I think it's very clear the Supreme Court's not going to do anything about this problem anytime soon. So I think the battles are at the state level, and it's about trying to change how we do redistricting from having the parties that control the state legislature do the redistricting to making it more of an independent process. And there's clear bipartisan support for this. And I think we're going to see, you know, independent redistricting commissions or some limits on gerrymandering adopted in places like Michigan and Utah and Colorado. Every poll I've seen, no matter where the state is, shows strong bipartisan support for this kind of thing. And I think one of the things that's interesting to me is that the debate over voting rights has become so politicized, and it's also broken down so much in terms of party, which is if you're a Republican, you support making it harder to vote, and if you're a Democrat, you support making it easier to vote. And there's obviously, you know, some distinctions between that, but by and large, that has been the dominant narrative. And what I see on the local level is that there's actually a lot more support for the policies that I'm talking about than at the the political level, that in fact a majority of people support giving ex-felons the right to vote. They support a nonpartisan redistricting. They support automatic voter registration and election day registration. Yeah, a lot of them are going to support voter ID too, because 90% of people have the correct ID. But on all of these other issues, I think you can make a lot of progress on voting rights. And only about 28 states allow ballot initiatives, so there's only so far you can go with this. But what I would say is, you know, if Trump remains president and if the courts remain extremely conservative and if the Congress remains deadlocked, I think working at the state level is the quickest way to change the dynamic over voting rights.
You know, it's a compelling argument to everybody that voters should choose politicians rather than have politicians choose their voters. I think that's real simple. It kind of fits on a bumper sticker. Obviously, that's pertinent to the districting issue. Before I let you go, there's a potentially significant, potentially huge fight underway that I'm not sure most people have been following or understand. The Trump regime is trying to add a question about citizenship to the 2020 census. This is one of those things that may appear kind of reasonable, like why not get a handle on how many immigrants are living in this country? Why not get a handle on, you know, how many citizens are in each district? But it's actually pretty perfidious. Can you talk about what's wrong with this, Ari, and maybe give us an update on where that battle stands?
Yeah, so I would say that the battle over the census is probably the most underreported and under-the-radar fight that's going to have a huge impact on democracy over the next decade. And what the Trump administration has proposed doing is to add a question about U.S. citizenship to the census for the first time since 1950. And this is such a big deal because the census is constitutionally mandated to count every person in America, regardless of their status. So it's a census of the actual enumeration of the population, meaning if you're, you know, rich or old, if you're older or young, if you're rich or poor, if you're a citizen or non-citizen, you are counted in the census. Well, the worry here is that asking about citizenship at a time when this administration is deporting a record number of people, when children are being separated from their families, is that many immigrant groups, both undocumented and even some documented people, are not going to respond to the census if this question about U.S. citizenship is on there. And that's going to lead to a skewed census count. That's going to mean that areas with a higher number of immigrants will receive fewer economic resources, will receive fewer political resources, meaning they'll have less representation in Congress, they'll have less representation in the Electoral College. And what it also means is that the Trump administration, I think this is what they really want to do, will be able to draw districts to exclude non-citizens from counting towards representation altogether. And that would mean that at a time when the country is becoming more diverse, districts themselves will become whiter and more Republican. And so I think basically what the administration is trying to do with the census is try to rig and manipulate the census as a way to try to stop the changing demographics of the country from being reflected in the census itself. So this is really, really important because the census is essentially the DNA of our democracy. It affects so many other things, from how $675 billion in federal funding is allocated, to how districts are drawn, to how the Electoral College is allocated. And if that underlying DNA is manipulated, is infected, is skewed, then everything else that follows from it, billions of dollars, huge amounts of political representation, will be corrupted as well. So I think everyone really needs to pay attention to this. And where we're at right now is we're kind of at two different places. One is that there are six different lawsuits against this question. The first trial is going to be in New York City on November 5th, the day before the midterm. So we're going to probably get a ruling on this sometime next year. And then there's also a lot of fights right now just procedurally, because what's happening is that top officials in the administration, including the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, are being forced to give depositions under oath. And this is so important because the administration had a rationale for this question, which they said it was needed to better enforce the Voting Rights Act, which is completely farcical given that this administration has never shown an ounce of interest in enforcing the Voting Rights Act. And these depositions under oath, I think, are going to reveal the real purpose for this question, which is politically motivated to try to harm immigrant communities. And I think the more we learn through these lawsuits, the more we see what the real purpose of this was.
And I really want to stress this point that you made. They're doing this for partisan political purposes. They're doing this for districting, basically, and related matters, but all sorts of federal funding is also allocated according to these population estimates. So this is really, really important beyond politics. It gets to all sorts of programs and whether they're going to be funded adequately. And let me also just point out that there is this other entire issue with the census, which is that it has been underfunded and has had all sorts of problems. There's real concerns among wonks who follow this thing that we're going to have an incomplete or flawed census process next year. And this is something that people really, really need to keep an eye on. Ari, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I know you're out in Iowa and you're doing your thing. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Josh. Always great to talk to you.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back. She wouldn't need to be a bird out of the wind or be a servant to a telephone ring. She could be sleeping in the comfort of a rubber band. Welcome back. I'm happy to be joined now by Brian Schaffner. Brian is a political scientist at Tufts University. He's been conducting a series of empirical studies that tend to back up what a lot of us know intuitively about how Donald Trump's rhetoric has led to a coarser, nastier political discourse in this country. Brian, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again.
When we last had Brian on, we spoke about a study he conducted that found that white respondents were more likely to express open prejudice against a number of different subgroups after they were exposed to Donald Trump's infamous rant about, Mexico sending us their rapists. Brian has a new paper out. I guess it came out last month that seems especially timely given this week's hearings for Brett Kavanaugh, or I guess it was last week's hearings and this week's tense confirmation process. Brian, what did you set out to study here?
Well, this was a pretty similar to what I was sort of interested in with the other paper, which is, but just from the perspective of thinking about it, sexism and sort of Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail in 2016 and all the sexist things he was saying. And I was interested in the extent to which people were willing to sort of reject that kind of rhetoric, and whether their willingness to reject that kind of rhetoric was sort of contingent on who it was saying those things. So in other words, I felt like, you know, Trump was getting a pass for saying things that people might not otherwise be willing to sort of stomach. And so that was part of the project, was that. And then also I was sort of interested in how his victory might have changed what people were willing to say after he had won re-election. So the paper sort of looks at both those things.
So you conducted two experiments. Let's just take them in turn. Can you give us a rundown of how you designed the first one?
So the first experiment I ran on a survey that was conducted during October before the election in 2016. And it was very simple. It's just basically I just asked people two versions of a question. And one version of the question I asked them, if an acquaintance of yours, called a woman a dog and referred to his wife as a beautiful piece of ass, would this make you uncomfortable or not? And people could just sort of rate how uncomfortable those statements would make them on a scale. And then in the other version of the question that the other half of people got was I just gave them the same statements, but I said, you know, Donald Trump has said these things. Basically, I wanted to look at how responses to basically the extent to which people said that they felt uncomfortable, how that varied depending on which version of the question they got.
And their partisan leanings.
Exactly. Yeah. And basically what you find is for Democrats, it doesn't matter, if it's an acquaintance or it's Trump, they overwhelmingly feel uncomfortable with those statements. For Republicans, in the version where they're asked about an acquaintance saying those things, they are, you know, not quite as uncomfortable as Democrats are with those statements, but about 60%, you know, said that they were uncomfortable or very uncomfortable hearing those things. But when I attributed those statements to Trump, that dropped by 20 percentage points all the way down to 40%. So basically people were much less willing to say that they felt uncomfortable about those statements when Trump was the one saying them versus an acquaintance of theirs.
That is Republicans. Now, there wasn't a statistically significant effect for Democrats. Did that surprise you? Would you think that our animosity towards Trump would make us less comfortable than an acquaintance saying those things?
I was a little surprised that it didn't increase, although I think part of the reason for that is that it was already the case that 85% of Democrats were uncomfortable with those statements. So there wasn't really that much room for it to go up from there. So I think part of the reason you didn't see an increase among Democrats was just that there was already sort of widespread discomfort.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. I wrote a piece for The Nation about your earlier paper and I titled it, "Yes, Donald Trump is Making White People More Hateful," but that was just a headline. And the reality is that this is, and we talked about this the last time you were on, this is about Trump being a major party presidential candidate and basically signaling that the norms of polite society have perhaps shifted and now allow people to express the prejudices that they already harbor. Is something similar going on here?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in the paper, I talk about what psychologists call a justification suppression model of prejudice. And the basic idea is that everyone has some sort of internally held prejudice towards other groups. And on a daily basis, we suppress that prejudice to some extent because it makes us uncomfortable to be feeling that kind of prejudice internally, or because of external norms. Like we feel like if we express a certain level of prejudice that it would upset people who are in our social networks or that kind of thing. So for whatever reason, you know, a lot of us suppress how much prejudice we might actually have internally. But sometimes we encounter justifications in order to express prejudice. So justifications essentially relax how much we suppress our prejudice. So, for example, in the case of this experiment, the idea could very well be that it's not necessarily that people actually feel less or would feel less uncomfortable about this when Trump says it versus an acquaintance, but it might be that they feel the need to say that if an acquaintance said these things, it'd be uncomfortable. But when we introduce those statements coming from Trump, well, now they feel a justification to actually not suppress their prejudice as much. So they say, well, Trump is my party's presidential candidate. And so I, you know, like, while I don't want to express this prejudice, doing so sort of helps him. And so maybe I'm willing to actually express a bit more prejudice than I would otherwise.
I thought that the internal piece of this was really interesting in that it's not just how one perceives that others might respond to your, you know, bigoted or sexist statements. It's also about how people perceive themselves. Most people, right. I guess, don't think of themselves or don't want to think of themselves as harboring these prejudices. It's really interesting stuff. So then when you see... then we move, I guess, to the second study where we talk more about the validation of those views that Trump's victory may have conferred. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Brian Schaffner from Tufts University. So let's move on to that second experiment. Can you set that one up for us?
Yeah. So that one's actually what we're doing here is not so much an experiment. It's really just tracking attitudes among the same people over time. And so we ran a survey in October 2016, right before the election. And one of the things I asked people in the survey was these items for what's called the hostile sexism battery, which is basically just a battery of items that are meant to measure how much resentment people feel towards women, and especially the extent to which women might be sort of trying to gain equality with men. So we measured that in October, right before the election, and then we re-interviewed the exact same people in March of 2017, and then we re-interviewed them again in July of 2018. So these are the exact same people. And basically what we find in this study, and we ask them the same questions in each of those waves. And what we find is actually that these measures, these items, which pick up this concept of hostile sexism, that Republicans give more sexist responses to those items after the election than they did before the election. And I think, again, and this, it increases in March of 2017, and it stays at the same level that it increased to in July of 2018. So in other words, Republicans after the election are essentially giving more sexist or expressing more sexism in this survey, and it's persisted into 2018. And again, you could read that two ways. You could say, well, Republicans have become more sexist, or another reading, which I think might be the more accurate one, is to say, like, Republicans just now feel more justified to express their sexism because the candidate who sort of did that during the campaign won the election. And what that might have showed them is that actually maybe these types of viewpoints are more widespread than they thought, and maybe it's okay to express these kinds of views.
Right. So if you're the only guy at the shop who, you know, listens to Rush Limbaugh, you might know, okay, these guys that I work with aren't going to be that comfortable. But then when you see a president get 60, whatever million votes, you say, well, listen, these ideas are not something that are obscure or fringe. Mm-hmm. They're mainstream. So that's one piece of it. But then you write, and I'll quote you, a person who otherwise might feel negatively about themselves for expressing prejudicial viewpoints may feel significantly better about doing so if it helps them achieve partisan motivated mm-hmm. goals. You talk about partisan motivated reasoning. Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, I think you see that in both of the studies. And basically the idea here is that, you know, if you think about the sorts of views and attitudes that we express, and it's sort of, you can think about it as sort of a struggle within ourselves, and we're weighing different considerations and things. And so, like, absent of partisan politics, we might feel, like maybe we shouldn't say things that are so sexist or express views that are so sexist. But when sexism becomes sort of viewed through a partisan lens, which I think, is especially happening right now, right in this moment, then that sort of pushes in the other direction, says, well, my team, my party is basically the party that's expressing sort of maybe this hostility towards women. And therefore, by endorsing these statements, I'm sort of, supporting my team. And so basically, that gives people sort of a bit of a push in the other direction to say, well, maybe you should endorse these sexist statements, because that's sort of, that supports your party's side in this debate.
And we should note that there wasn't a significant effect for Democrats. And again,
that's right,
they started at a baseline where they had a relatively low degree of agreement with those statements. Perhaps the most interesting finding was that there wasn't a significant difference between this effect on Republican men and women. Can it be that partisanship trumps women's own lived experiences?
Yes. I would say yes. it's a simple answer, actually, but it's not to say that gender or lived experiences aren't important, but a lot of that's already baked in to what party they're in the first place. So, one of the things that, if you look at the debate and what especially liberals have been sort of maybe expecting, oh, well, this is going to turn Republican women away from the party. The women who are still in the Republican Party at this point are perfectly fine with these kinds of sentiments. Like they right, wouldn't be Republicans at this point if they weren't. And so, exactly what I show is that Republican women score almost as high on this hostile sexism measure as Republican men do. And they also increase in their hostile sexism after Trump wins. In fact, the effect of gender is bigger in the Democratic Party. That there actually is a somewhat of a gap between Democratic men and Democratic women on the sexism measure, but there's a very small difference between Republican men and Republican women. They very much share their support for hostility towards women's equality and those kinds of statements.
And to be fair to Republican women, there's quite a bit of data showing that a lot of the college educated women at least have indeed bailed, and that's why a lot of like suburban districts are going to be competitive this fall, or should be competitive this fall. That's one big reason for it. Is there anything that you would extrapolate from all of this for what we're seeing right now with the Kavanaugh hearings?
It's sort of rough to watch from this perspective, because sort of see what the outcome of the 2016 election does to these measures, and you see a debate that is so intensely focused on exactly these issues about women and equality and that kind of thing, and that it's seemingly becoming even more polarized along partisan lines than it even was before. And I mean, it's hard not to expect that Republicans might, after these hearings and after this confirmation vote, and because of this controversy, might come to even express even more strongly anti-women statements in these scales, simply because it's, you're making this Me Too movement and these debates about gender equality basically such a partisan issue that to maintain one's identity as a Republican, you almost have to come to endorse sort of these anti-women statements more and more. I'm working with a colleague where we went out and surveyed people right before the hearing with Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh, and asked a lot of these items, and we were going to re-interview them after the vote to see whether that's actually the case, whether this has even further polarized the parties on measures like these hostile sexism measures.
I thought you were going to say we went out drinking, because that's how I'm dealing with all of this. Brian Schaffner, I really appreciate you taking the time. I believe we are out of time, but thanks so much for sharing your work with us. I really do appreciate it.
Of course. Happy to chat with you.
I'd also like to thank Dahlia Lithwick and Ari Berman. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean, SoundCloud, wherever else you get them. I'd like to thank the good folks at Hullabaloo, Smirking Chimp, Crooks and Liars for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you very good people. Stay strong this week.